ARPH is pleased to present the memoirs of Tilly Aston, Australia's blind poet, author and philanthropist. The story told of the many-faceted life of this talented woman is intriguing. The memoirs of Tilly Aston is published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. Episode 6.
Early days of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind. When the work of providing books for the blind had been started, it was soon apparent that other needs were very pressing. To begin with, our blind were so scattered that only a very small proportion could be located. Then, the taste for reading had not been developed to any extent. Disabilities, when travelling, annoyed and inconvenienced us. The right to vote at elections was often refused us because we were not able to use pen and ink, and many other grievances added to the difficulties of our handicap. Something had to be done to alter these conditions, and I realized at the same time that no one but the blind themselves could handle such matters in the proper spirit. At that period, I was living with my people in Nicholson Street, South Yarra, and a few of my companions, chiefly those I had known at school, were wont to drop in for a chat. One night, a few of us got together for a solid discussion of our grievances in Mother's Parlour. I cannot name them all, but Will Hall and Charlie Taylor were there, and most likely Dave Blakely and Katie McDougall. After much talk, I agreed to summon a meeting for the purpose of starting a literary and debating club for the blind, from which it was hoped that something wider and more practical would grow. I regret that memory does not serve me well enough to give all particulars of the origin of the movement. Unfortunately, the minutes of the first 10 years of our work were left in the train and never recovered. However, I feel certain, after conferring with Mr. Dave Robertson, that the following facts are a fragment of the history of our beginnings. My home was not big enough to hold the number we expected for this first meeting, and Miss Blakely's mother let us have the use of her parlour for the occasion. Only 8 of the blind answered my summons. There were present Mr. Dave Robertson and his sister, Dave Blakely, George Cobain, and Tom Marks, myself and 2 others of whom I cannot be positively certain. Mrs. Hall and Taylor wished to be there, but were prevented by more urgent duties. So we had our meeting, and my idea of a literary club, though desirable as part of our programme, was shown to be inadequate. We elected Mr. Robertson as our first president. I took the position of secretary and treasurer, and we set out on that enterprise which has culminated in our powerful organization, in a vast improvement of conditions for the blind, and in a development of citizenship which has come to our people through giving their time and ability to the service of others, their fellow blind. At first, my duties as treasurer were not onerous. Members paid a shilling to enter, and a shilling a year after that. Therefore, I began with 8 shillings, and that soon went in postage as I tried to round up the scattered ranks. Soon we were obliged to find a new meeting place, and through the interest of Miss Kate McDougall, we were granted the use of the church hall at the Presbyterian Church, Punt Road, South Yarra. For many years we enjoyed this privilege, and I recall it with gratitude, for our members grew in numbers, and so did our work grow in proportion. Later it was felt that a more central meeting place was advisable, because our members must travel from all parts of Melbourne and suburbs, and in those days street services and rail travel were meagre compared with those of the present day. Among the first jobs we tackled was the keeping of a register of the names and addresses of all the blind we could find. I obtained the census figures from the state, and found that there were 1,097 sightless persons in our community. At least, that was the number recorded. Of this number, we knew the whereabouts of only about 1/4, so I wrote to country clergymen and schoolmasters, asking them to send names and addresses of any blind, old or young, living in their districts. Very few were the answers we received, and some wrote that there were no cases of blind in their locality. Later, we learned that this information was not reliable, which could be explained by the fact that so many of these handicapped people lived in their homes like birds in a cage, and that even neighbours were scarcely aware of their existence. For the city, we adopted a different plan. Miss Janie Robertson, sister of our first president, offered to devote some days a week to finding out and visiting our people. This was purely a work of love, and I doubt whether she got as much as her fares for her arduous work. This was a splendid move, and we still have our Register of the Blind of this state, and our visiting system is one of our most important activities, carrying comfort, information, instruction, or financial aid, where necessary, to the lonely ones, too old or too sick to share in other privileges we have provided for the rest. The Robertson brother and sister are still with us at the time of writing, October 1944, and are still high in the lists of my friends, who through all the ups and downs of my leadership of the association have proved loyal-hearted, earnest, and sound in both judgment and principles. It is not my purpose in this book to give a complete history of the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, so that would be a long story. As the years flew, however, our cares and labours increased, and also our achievements. We had the immigration law, so regulated that we could now travel from state to state without the humiliating scenes at trains or boats which had annoyed us and our friends. The anomalies in voting were corrected. The disability of having to pay for oneself and attendant when travelling was alleviated by travelling rebates and concessions, which we secured. And perhaps the greatest boon of all we obtained was free postage for embossed literature within the Commonwealth. Of course, there was the raising of funds, for we soon found that money must be got if we were to meet our growing responsibilities. In this department, we knew that the help of sighted friends was indispensable. I wish I could name them all, but a few must be mentioned, as they were outstanding in their generous aid, asking neither honour nor power for themselves, desiring only that we blind people should have a chance to serve and uplift our fellows, and in so doing, to uplift ourselves. First and last, too, as he is still with us and still our devoted friend, is Mr. W. H. Patterson, lately Senior Deputy Registrar General and Senior Assistant Registrar of Titles for this state. 4 years before the starting of our organization, while he was still little more than a youth, he arranged an annual social gathering, which we knew as Miss Thorne's Treat for the Blind, so that his active service is actually longer than my own. When we began to expand our work, he came in with us, bringing his tolerant spirit and his tenacious purpose to our cause. He always believed that the blind could do it themselves and wanted only to help us around stiff corners. What our movement owes to him can never be told, but his friendship is to me a personal treasure, to which he has added that of his sweet wife, just as enthusiastic for our independence as her husband had always been. Another friend in our beginnings was Dr. S. McBurney, a gentleman of great charm and kindliness, always interested in the welfare of the blind, and most approachable, as was also his wife. He was a doctor of music, and lent us his help in getting up concerts, and became a trustee as soon as we had enough assets to need such an official. A third and wonderful friend we made was Mr. Charles Monteith, of the South Melbourne firm of iron founders of that name. This gentleman was attracted to our work through an old sea captain in whom he was interested. The man of the sea had gone blind, and hearing of our efforts to rehabilitate such cases, Mr. Monteith brought him to see me, and I soon had him learning Braille and anxious to do something to help himself. Mr. Monteith was so pleased over the restored happiness of Captain Watson that he came in with us and was a most understanding helper. His business associations brought us many gifts and subscribers which we should have missed out without him. He worked with us until failing health forced him to withdraw, and his cheery Scottish voice still lingers in my memory whenever I think of those early days of the AAB. Another friend of those days I commemorate here. He was George Maxwell, a son of the Punt Road manse. He was always kind to the blind about his district, even while in his student years. Then, when he became a lawyer, he gave freely of his special talents, both to the individuals and to our association, as soon as we began to buy land or enter into contracts and agreements. With his rise to power, he never became too exalted to lend a hand, and his influence on behalf of our cause as member of the Federal Parliament won us several privileges. Blindness overtook him about the age of 54, and then he was indeed one of us. For some years he held office as our president and paid his footing there by his efforts to secure more advantageous conditions in the matter of invalid pensions. To me personally, he was always most cordial, and a good sound yarn always marked our meetings. Indeed, he was my friend as well as a staunch supporter of the cause I had espoused on behalf of the blind, and his splendid courage in facing the handicap of blindness was always a marvel to me. There is still another I cannot leave out of this record. It was Miss Elsie Tate, also from the South Yarra Manse. She joined up with us at the time we were meeting in the church hall at her home, and for long years acted as our sighted assistant secretary. In due time, she married Herbert Lawrence, one of the finest of our blind men, and after his death continued to be one of our most faithful helpers. Still, when there is sickness in any of the homes of our people, if a helping hand is needed at a social gathering, if someone is lonely or sad, or must make trips to doctor or hospital, a call for Mrs. Lawrence brings the dear, efficient woman to share the burdens and straighten out the tangles. Such precious souls as hers are a gift of God, for which I at least am devoutly thankful. For 9 years I served as honorary secretary and treasurer, and by the end of this period we had an office in Oxford Chambers and our meetings at the Assembly Hall, Little Collins Street, Melbourne. I was beginning to find the strain of the work rather heavy, especially as the advancing years of my mother, increasing home responsibilities, and my bread-and-butter job as a music teacher made great demands on my energy. So we decided to appoint a secretary at a very low salary, and Mr. T. Marks was installed in the office. The members wished me to retain my leadership in some form, and duly elected me as president. Our enterprises went on as before, as we played the part of watchdog over the interests of the blind in every sphere that presented itself. Rail, tram, and travelling concessions, the administration of relief where needed, visiting work, and much besides. Then came our biggest effort so far, the opening of the home at Brighton Beach, a need for which had been pressed upon us by the deplorable conditions our field workers discovered in some of the cases under their care. Mr. Patterson was a tower of strength to us in this emergency. It was he who found the house at Mare Street, put through the negotiations for purchase, and organized a carnival at the Glaciarium, which brought in funds that were devoted to the costs. Many helped us to furnish, and as soon as we were ready, we began to gather there homeless ones, those who were unwanted by their relatives, some who needed rest and recuperation. Great numbers have passed through this place of rest, finding shelter from adversity, and that kindly attention so desirable in the final hours of life. Looking back over the 35 years that have gone since the founding of this home, I feel that it was an inspired thought which originated it, and I am certain that many of those who have used this home will say the same thing. Free postage of embossed literature was obtained for us chiefly through the good offices of Mr. Frank Tudor, MHR. Two of our most energetic blind members, Messrs. Holgate and Barber, lived in his electorate and captured his interest in our efforts to relieve ourselves of some of our disabilities. This gentleman, after consultation with our committee, got the concession embodied in a small private bill, which was shortly afterwards made law by Parliament. Only those who know the bulk and weight of our books and magazines can appreciate the enormous value of this privilege, and I hold that through it we have made a vast contribution to the education and culture of our blind, and at the same time to the nation at large. Mr. Tudor was one of the friendliest of men, and was wont to join us at our picnics and socials, where he learnt to recognise our needs and our aspirations. For his fine gift of free postage, eternal gratitude is due. Mr. Tudor brought another friend into our circle, Mr. Robert Solly, also a parliamentary representative. Bob Solly, as most people called him, was one of the easiest to get on with, and was on the committee of our Brighton home for a considerable period. He was so reasonable and so understanding of our ways of thinking that all the blind liked him. It is a happy experience to have known him, but for that matter, those were happy days, full of enterprise and hopeful toil, bringing alleviations for my handicapped family. So things moved on harmoniously until about the year 1912. Two more poems of Tilly. Brotherhood. True brotherhood can never lie in pity's mild and tender eye, for pity stoops from heights above and condescends a meed of love to pour upon the hearts below that waste and suffer in their woe. There is no brotherhood in him who only scans the orbit dim of lower planes in human life and holds himself above the strife that moulds all human destiny and powers of posterity. It is no brother's part to stand with eye serene and nerveless hand while men of courage sweat and fight in the defence of what is right. Nay, if you cannot say Godspeed, you must against them take the lead. They are our brother men who know through self-same pang a brother's woe, who read as clear as on a scroll in every man a heaven-born soul, whose dignity is that alone which cannot brook a tyrant tone. That poem was published in Songs of Light. And now, sowing and reaping. I never sought the easy path to tread, to wait on others for my daily bread, to toil and strive, to finish and achieve. This is the faith in which I do believe. An ever-present joy, the testing hard of those fair talents given me to guard, and sweeter still the day when doubled powers bring double duties with their richer hours. I have been willing to expend my days, knowing for certain that the future pays, and knowing, too, that every good thing won is but the answer to the service done. No fruitful then without the toilsome now, no harvest rich without the rending plough, without the shady valves, no mountain height, where man can climb and find the perfect light. The days of gathering experience. During the 17 years in which, as secretary and president, I was using most of my powers to build up the Association for the Advancement of the Blind, there were other happenings which contributed a definite value to my mental and spiritual development. I have mentioned a concert tour to Tasmania. But sometime after the founding of our library, my friend, Mrs. Hunt, whose husband was the lessee of the Metropole in Launceston, invited me to spend 3 months with her and help in organizing a society of Braille writers over there. It was a delightful holiday. I stayed at the Metropole much of the time and met my new pupils who were destined to form the library for the blind in the north of the island. Later I went south to Hobart to do a little of the same kind of work in that town. The journey was taken by car, my first long ride in an automobile. It was a picnic journey, meals by the roadside at lovely banks, and beside the broad waters of the Derwent. At Hobart I stayed a few weeks in the home of Mr. S. Mann, at the time railway commissioner. From there I added a few Braillists to the rank of the transcribers, and was happy with the wife of my host. There were other holidays spent in Tasmania, where I was always welcome among my friends. Once it was with the Wilsons of Mount Nassau, near Bridgewater. Across the stream from the house was the moaning Mount Dromedary, and weird cries of waterfowl startled me from my sleep at night. It was here I found perfect fossils in the limestone brought in from the kilns. The lime burning was one of the industries of the Mount Nassau estate. My inquiring mind was filled with these things, and my senses were steeped in the beauty of my surroundings, until I gave words to it all in some of my poems. Next time I visited the Hunts and Wilsons, these two families in which the wives were sisters had moved down the South Channel to Birches Bay, where there was still more entrancing prospect than at Mount Nassau. Apples everywhere, giant berries of nectar quality, berries that warranted that proverbial second bite, wonderful beans and lettuces, flowers so luxuriant and plentiful that I marvelled. On quiet nights I could hear the faint roar of the sea on the neck between North and South Brunei, and happy birds came about the house to dip their beaks in the juicy plums and pears in the orchard round about. We wandered the beaches of the tiny bays, gathering shells and listening to the whisper of the calm tides. Sometimes we rocked gently in Mr. Wilson's boat as he fished, or with a lantern speared a fat flounder for my breakfast. Intense were the impressions of the Arcadian life of those summer days, and to me, quite unforgettable. Many echoes of those holidays in Tasmania are found in my writings, for although I had just begun to set my thoughts in verse, I was storing up for later times, as I had been doing from the days of my childhood, ready for the hour when my inspiration could get to its singing. But not all my holidays were spent on the other side of Bass Strait. It will be recalled that I met Mr. Monteith through befriending a sailor in whom he was interested, Captain William Watson of Sorrento. The old blind gentleman lived with the family of his brother in this little seaside paradise, and they had built him a comfortable cabin in the garden, well within call of the homestead. There, Uncle Will would smoke his pipe, potter about growing vegetables for the family, cultivating his peaches, plums, and tomatoes, while he could always pause for a yarn with any chance passer-by, or sit down for a solid gossip with a friend. Mr. Monteith felt that reading would dispel the monotony of the days and nights of this lonely man, and he got him up to Melbourne for a few days, bringing him to my home to see if anything could be done for him. The plucky old salt was game to try Braille, and succeeded so well that later there was a regular correspondence between Sorrento and the Aston House. This was not accomplished in one lesson, however, and the Watsons invited me to pay them a visit, see the beauties of Sorrento, and give Uncle Will a few extra hints. The memory of those charming girls, of their goodness to the old blind man, and their lavish attention to myself is still a bright spot to look back upon. They brought to my notice everything of interest and charm in the place. We walked the white limestone road, smooth as a pavement in the spring, through miles of blossoming tea tree, almost overwhelmed by the fragrance of the flowers, mixed with the scent of the clematis wreaths draped over the taller bushes. The waters of Port Phillip lapped at our door, and shelly sands were there for wandering feet and collecting hands. Away along the sandy tracks we would go, through the scrub and out onto the cliffs above St. Paul's Bay, to listen to the oncoming ocean and the gurgling sweep of the waves as they charged over the rocks. Never before had I been near the ocean, and its deep voice had an awe and fascination for me which rather amused the girls. Often I would stand outside at night and try to fix the absolute pitch of its note, just as I might have done with a great organ. But with this sound, as with all mighty vibrations, the keynote is so all-embracing that it can sing any tune in the mind. One evening, Mr. Russell, husband of one of the daughters, came in for a hurried tea. He was a member of the lifeboat crew, and orders to be ready had gone out, for the sea was roaring like a thousand monsters, and we could perceive a tremor in the earth beneath our feet, even on the bayside of the peninsula. Some ship might need help on that wild coast of the back beach, where it is so easy in a storm to miss the entrance to Port Phillip. Mrs. Russell proposed that we should go to the back beach and have a look at the storm. Muffled in coats, with our hair tied down with scarves, we set off by sheltered tracks through the tea tree, vaguely realizing the fury of the wind, until suddenly there burst upon me the fiercest blast I have ever faced. It lashed me with sand and sea spray, drummed in my ears and shrieked around the rocks and hummocks, while below crashed and thundered roller after roller, as if it would batter away through the narrow isthmus to the bay beyond. It was awesome, terrible. Our senses were benumbed by the noise and strife. We could not stand against it, and falling on our hands and knees, we crept back into the shelter of the tea tree and got our breath after a brief rest. How the scrub stood up against the wind is a mystery still, for with all our will we found standing unbearable and breathing the greatest of effort. Many ships have been lost on that wild, rocky coast, and having experienced the force of wind and wave there, I well understand the nature of their perils.
And that brings us to the end of episode 6 of The Memoirs of Tilly Aston, published by Hawthorne Press and read by Pamela Adams. The series was produced in the studios of 3RPH Melbourne for the RPH Network.